before anything I know, which is that I should start the. And I look at the little typing. Is there a mouse?
Yes. So you don't. You can just tell us about the type.
Okay, I'll just tell you about the type. You can probably spot it already. I don't want to have the type wrong in the title. Never mind. Today is still not going to be relative to what we heard this morning at 11 o'clock. Quite as heavyweight theory as that. And in fact, relative to that, you can say that today's talk of mine is still observation. I'm going to focus upon this problem of the dense disease. And you could phrase the title in another way, since typing one keyword is wrong. Anyhow, that's in more layman terms, how are structures formed? Okay, and then if you want to further exaggerate the title along that direction, it could even be construed as meaning, you know, where do we come from? And the sort of dense disease I am referring to, or I shall be focusing on most of the time today, will be the very early dense disease, and that is the ones that were planted well before these density contrasts have evolved to the sort of present-day galaxies and clusters of galaxies, as well as groups of galaxies that we observe. Now, they have to have a certain pattern of behavior in order for gravity to work upon them, and then gradually allowing them to develop into today's structures. It is not only just simply gravity at work. If there are other forces in nature, then those have to be taken into account. So the whole thing, in a sense, is still going to be observationally driven more than anything else. And that is that you can start with gravity, and then you ask yourself, what are those seeds that need to be planted at the infancy of the universe in order to correspond to the galaxy clusters at low gravity? But then you find out that later, from the CMB observations at the Large Scale Surface, that in fact those density seeds don't resemble anything that we expect them to be. Then something else has to happen, and that is that you have to change the physics and add in extra elements beyond gravity. If you run out of freedom in your model to play around with these various quantities or parameters to match theory and predictions with observations. Now, that in fact, this kind of very haphazard way to in which science typically advances is precisely also what's happening here. And that is that we find that when we look at the Large Scale Surface, we don't see what we wanted to see. Okay. And that's one of the reasons or motivation for bringing or reinstating the dark energy concept that originally Einstein called it the biggest blunder of his life. So I'm going to start off with precisely this Large Scale Surface. In fact, this is a view graph you saw yesterday, if you were here yesterday. And that is that you see these living density perturbations. But of course, there are perturbations on all scales, including the so-called supervisor scale. That is that if you look across the sky from one end to the other, then this would correspond to a physical distance scale that at the time of last sketch will be many horizons of separation between points, and then therefore those points couldn't have been in causal connection with each other. So the fact that the CMB looks so uniform on those distance scales, remarkably uniform, means that somehow we've got a little bit of explaining to do. And that is that, either you allow communication or information to propagate at speeds higher than that of light, or you will have to think of something else that will allow or permit the universe to be much more in touch with each other, those various regions. So effectively saying that the universe was more compact in its very beginning than its state during the last Edmund surface. Now to highlight the horizon problem, so in much more down-to-earth terms, so imagine yourself here down on Earth, and that is looking at two opposite points on the last scattering surface. And each point is already one light universe away, shall we say. Okay? And that is that it takes light to travel from A to the Earth. The time necessary is the entire age of the universe, or very close to it. And the same applies from B to the Earth, and therefore from A to B, you are going to run out of time altogether. So how could A afford to B in order for the CMB to look so big? So uniform across such big scales. So this is one enigma that I already mentioned yesterday, but perhaps today, from a more theoretical viewpoint on how we just as how the various ideas came about to solve it. The second enigma is the flatness problem. Now, all these problems actually are intimately related, okay, in the context of lambda CDM at least. And that is that the horizon and flatness, as well as the appearance of the density seeds, and whether they appear in such a way that gravity could form the structures today, starting with, or whether we need additional physics. Okay. Everything is controlled by what we see in the CFD. And in fact, if on the last scattering surface there's ample supply, then we just have to come up with ample revisions of the physical mechanisms. And so this flatness problem here is a long story, but to make it simple to understand, we are saying that the parameters that needed to explain these sequence perturbations on the last scattering surface would, in a local range of degrees of freedom, favor a solution that assumes that the universe has zero curvature. Okay. Now, this is not to say there are no other solutions. That's what this Bayesian prior problem has to do with. And that is that if you seek a starting point, another solution that's way away from the from this range of parameter values, then you could end up with something very different. But in particular, the most important quantity in charge of all this is the Hubble constant. And let's say if you want the Hubble constant to be anywhere near the value of 70 kilometers per second megaparsec, then you unavoidably will arrive at the conclusion that the universe is flat. All right, so to knit everything together, along comes this this esoteric theory to the rescue. But in fact, it turns out that it's able to kill so many birds with one stone that it then eventually became the canon. And that is that the theory assumes at the very beginning, or soon after the Planck time, the universe inflated, right? Which means that if you were to project from the present radius all the way backwards in time, had inflation not taken place, then the universe would have been here. In other words, traveling or following the locus of this blue line. But it turns out that the universe was much smaller than that. So this would immediately explain away the horizon problem, and that is that everything was in very close touch before space, or different points in space, simply moved away from each other's superluminal. Now this is allowed by general relativity, and that is that as long as you don't worry about how those different points send light signals to each other, all right, so that they can in fact move away from each other at speeds faster than the speed of light. Only if you start then sending signals and you say that those different points can still remain capable of talking to each other, then you would start to violate the special theory of relativity. All right, so this is one way of depicting inflation. Another way is through a cartoon, and that is that you start with some radius that you could call the entire universe, and the true radius may be even bigger than that. Okay, and that is during the pre-inflationary phase, and that is soon after the Planck time, let's say. Okay, now this region is given by the yellow circle. Inside the yellow circle is a small part of the entire universe, and that may still be larger than the entire observable universe given by our Hubble radius of today. All right, so all that was before inflation. And let's say that the different points were closely in touch, and that is that they could send light signals to each other because the whole thing was just simply so compact at that time. But then along came the phase of inflation, and then you could see it happened so quickly that the green zone was completely gone, the black zone now fills the entire screen, and the blue zone, which in the previous slide didn't even appear because it was so small, now gets inflated to a region that is going to form either our entire observable universe or a good part of it. Okay, so after inflation ended, between then and large scattering, there's a further expansion of each structure because the universe was simply undergoing what is known as FRW, Friedman-Robertson-Walker type of evolution. And that is expanded, but not exponentially so. Okay, and in fact, if the universe had been radiation and then subsequently matter dominated after inflation, then this expansion would have been decelerating all along. All right, even though in real terms it's expanded, but it's kind of slowing down all the time. During inflationary phase, new physics came to play, and then the expansion was exponential. Very interesting, and in fact, a serious attempt to pull everything together to explain that under one roof. So that's the attractive part of it. Now, to further underline the point, inflation also attempts to explain, to account for the flatness problem. And here is simply a very layman realization of how it works, and that is that, of course, if a very small part of the universe is stretched, to become our entire observable horizon of today, then it would be equivalent to standing at some local high point, looking into the distant part of the Earth, such as a cliff looking out to the ocean, and to see whether one detects the fact that the Earth isn't flat by an experiment like that. And no doubt there's difficulty, because what we're seeing is a very small part of the Earth's surface. And all right, so in this respect, curvature is very close to one, but if the omega parameters turns out to be different from one by a couple of percent, then already inflation theory will be under challenge. All right, so then let's look at the physical mechanism, because if the various things on the large scattering surface, as I mentioned earlier, if they don't match the kind of expectation that we have based on what we see today in terms of the structures and based upon our knowledge of gravity ticking those structures back in time, well, then we need to invoke new physics. Now, one of the new physics has to do with what we call today the dark energy, and in fact, this very key piece of new ingredient here, you can say we call it the gas that hasn't arrived before 1995. Okay, I personally heard a talk by David Frank at that time in which he plotted a graph of lambda versus time since Einstein. I don't know how many of you saw the sine curve of Professor Frank, but the mean of that sine curve was zero. He thought that, in fact, lambda was just a complete waste of time. Now, here is something I excerpted from the book by Peebles, in fact. It's a figure that you probably came across. And it's to do with Professor William De Sitter, who was drawn in this way and in the cartoon. And moreover, there was some description of him in Dutch, but then translated into English, it says, "What, however, blows up the ball? What makes the universe expand or swell up?" And of course, in today's language, what makes the universe inflate? And that is done by lambda, and another answer cannot be given. So it seems to be very definitive, and that is that in the mind of De Sitter, really the true agent, the only agent that can possibly cause genuine expansion, namely accelerated expansion, what has to be the vacuum energy. Another answer cannot be given. Now, vacuum energy or lambda is, as you know, it has a long and winding road that, in fact, in the Einstein paper of 1917, which first coined this concept, he himself said it took him a long and winding journey to reach it. So taking us before that paper to really ancient times, you have this old train here that was 1916, in which all the elements of general relativity were in place except for, as you know, which term, okay? And then came 1917, in which Einstein said, "Well, I may have forgotten something, so plus lambda." And then this is 1998, you may have seen it, and that is on the front page of Science, and it's a drawing of Einstein pleasantly surprised, because after having suggested this idea of lambda, he then very quickly dismissed it as a big blunder of his life, and then here I think the idea is that he was looking at WMAP data, or WMAP 1A, or maybe boomerang after COVID. Or it's the first piece of evidence that suggests that the universe may be accelerating, because there's no other local solution to those CMB acoustic oscillations, unless you want to abandon
fictional. Well, this is supernova.
Supernova. Oh, supernova. I'm sorry. Yes, this is supernova. Nothing to do with CMB.
The next year was CMB.
Yeah. All right. Yes. So no boomerang support either, yes, disappearing from the the data of permuter, perhaps.
Yeah, man.
And also at a root.
And yes.
Okay, now, here is a simple mathematical calculation. Certainly very simple by the 11 o'clock standard of today. And so now I feel very much reduced after looking at that sort of mathematics. And that is that the Hubble constant may be written for a radiation-driven universe that carries a little bit of vacuum energy in this form. Now, the little bit of vacuum energy may be at a certain epic of the universe, but as you know very well, vacuum energy has the special property that because it belongs to space itself, that as space expands, the energy density does not go down. Whereas everything else scales depending on whether you're dealing with radiation or matter or something else with redshift. Okay? So in the case of radiation, it scales very rapidly with redshift. So you may start with a little bit of vacuum energy, which is nothing compared to radiation energy density. But eventually, if you wait long enough, then that you, all you're left with for your Hubble constant is just the square root of omega lambda. And that means the solution to this A dot over A equation would give you an exponential expansion. Now, but you see that the problem here is that if you follow De Sitter's reasoning and take it too literally, then it would be like Bohr's model of the hydrogen atom. And that is that you have a perfect atom that can't radiate. And then it's in this case, you will have, you will need some mechanism to end radiation, the inflation error to create a thermal state. Otherwise, you will just have an exponential inflation forever, or expansion forever. And this is not what we want. We do see a universe that underwent a thermal phase. All right, so then it means that some other hypothesis is still needed to put an end to arrest inflation. And so, and then moreover, to convert the energy of the force vacuum that triggered the process in the first place into thermal energy. Okay, now, but then in addition to all this, of course, you must have heard of this 10 to the power 120 contrivance, and that is this somehow, by the time all the energy of the force vacuum returned to thermal energy, then the final level of the vacuum, when it's reached the, what you could call the true vacuum state, turns out to be the level of the true vacuum of today, not that of any other earlier times. And it, moreover, this agreement is good to one part per 10 to the power 120. So then all sorts of questions arise, and that is, why did the force vacuum dissipate so completely and perfectly? And yet, assuming it did so, why is it today we are left with just that little bit of lambda, such that a number that we call 0.7 that allows the universe to undergo another stage of exponential expansion? Okay, so this is very strange. Any questions? Maybe I shouldn't keep going and I should pause.
I have a very ignorant question. For the accelerated expansion that's observed today, between like nucleosynthesis and the current epoch, is it known that, did something like that happen at some other point intervening? Or is this the first time since the original?
Nobody knows. That's the truth of the matter.
We know a lot about the history. So we know about nucleosynthesis. We have a very good idea about how fast the universe is expanding during nucleosynthesis. Very accurate measures.
This is what I was taught.
Yeah, and then we also see the
but things have changed since I was taught.
and then we see the CMB, which gives us a good indication of when which gives us another handle. And so we know basically how much radiation there is in the universe. And so then we can say that between nucleosynthesis and a certain time, radiation was the dominant thing. And we've seen structure form, which tells us that matter dominated for a long time. And we know how all of these things scale with volume. So we know pretty much, unless something really weird happened,
yes,
and there was a very brief period, whatever, you got some kind of dynamical thing that turned on and then turned right back off, that we had, this is the first time since.
That highlights the unusualness.
Yes, exactly. This is not something that's episodic within the universe, history of the universe.
Is inflation or the first time since nucleosynthesis?
This is inflation.
It's inflation,
yeah.
Oh, so it's inflation.
The data can only
be we know what was going on.
First time since reheating.
Yeah.
Reheating.
But there could be inflation after the inflation. So all we know is that from nucleosynthesis until now, things are under control. Before nucleosynthesis, things could have been crazy.
Yeah, things had to be hot at the beginning of nucleosynthesis. So.
That's right.
So it had to get there.
Yes, we had a hot beginning to nucleosynthesis. Everything's under control after. But that's about it. And we don't actually know that there was accelerated expansion before. For that, in fact, all we know is that there were these.
Yes, I agree. I mean, in fact, the simplest model is still a very strong model, and then it says there's no need to. If you apply the Occam's razor logic, then it means that we can say we do know, and there's no necessity whatsoever for introducing episodes of repeated inflation, although such theories do exist. I mean, in other words, it's mooted by the observation that if there was a phase of such undertaking, you know, in the very early stages, soon after the Planck time, and there is now another one, then what prevents us from assuming that in between there must have been repeated episodes? But the data do not demand this by any means. Okay? And also, I should encourage you to ask questions because primarily, as you probably could tell, I am not really a hardcore theoretician. And so at the best, you could say I am a phenomenologist who spends a lot of time worrying about data and the systematics of a data collection process, how do we use them? All right, now the current wisdom tells us that inflation ends at around 10 to minus 32 seconds. And when the universe was reheated to the grand unification theory temperature of about 10 to the 15 GeV of KT, and the details, the mechanism of the reheating is pretty much unknown. It's up for grabs. This the formulation of this part of the theory. And the reason is all that we believe that has taken place is that the reason is simple, and that is that at such high temperature we just so little physics is known in the lab in any physics. The current thinking says by that point the force vacuum would have evolved sufficiently close to the true vacuum state and may have shot past it, and then this allows the slow roll model of inflation to then take the universe through a sequence of oscillations which really represent a much more dynamic and rapid evolutionary stage. And it is through this oscillation and frictional dissipation that I personally confess I know little about. Probably Neil will tell you much more. And that would then allows the reheating, okay, to more or less just run the vacuum, the force vacuum out of steam altogether and converting all that energy back to heat. The previous stage, the pre-inflationary phase, all the thermal content of the universe would have been erased by that because of the exponential expansion. In other words, all that energy, if you were to ask where they've gone, then goodness knows where they've gone. This is a completely new stage, a brave new world here. And so therefore, Kirk and Turner simply stated that the only reason for worrying about the period before inflation is in terms of understanding what triggered inflation. Other than that, you might as well regard the reheating phase as the Big Bang itself. So that's the standard wisdom. And the whole thing reminds me a little bit about gamma ray bursts. And that's why sometimes gamma ray bursts are called mini Big Bangs. And that is, you start off with a very compact region of high energy density, which may be because of a pair of merging neutron stars or a collapsing supermassive black hole, but not actually by the AGN standard, but shall we say a hypernova type of collapsar. And then initially, if you do a quick calculation, you'll see that the gas was at gamma ray temperatures, all right, and it was completely thermal. But then the opacity is so enormous that the gamma rays couldn't possibly get out. And there's no way of observing this stage of the development, even though you do have gamma rays. Okay? But in order to see the gamma rays, you have to let the system expand outwards and cool down. But then the problem is the moment you let it expand outwards and cool down, it cools down very rapidly. All right, and it's not going to sit on that opportunity. And so it eventually, very quickly, in fact, the galleries would have been all redshifted away by the expansion. And so all that remains then would be a bulk flow energy, because here we're not talking about Hubble horizon or anything like that, and therefore energy is conserved. And that is the kinetic energy of the thermal motion gets converted into bulk motion, and in the form of, let's say, a twin jet heat. And then, so by the time that the whole system becomes optically thin and you can even observe it, already all the gamma rays are no more. Okay, that's where you can ask the question, well, why do we see gamma rays first in the first place? And it's been an enigma for a long time. All right, now what's generally believed is that at some stage, okay, you do need a relativistic shock to enable that bulk flow energy to be reconverted to heat. Okay, so it's somewhat like reheat. And it is at that stage that because the energy is still there, but now only in the form of cold bulk flow motion, you have to convert back to thermal energy, okay? Then you can, in fact, reheat back to gamma ray temperatures. So there are certain similarities, but we do have to remember the differences too, and that is that in the case of the inflation universe, there was no energy conservation in the global. Yet all these are still not enough, impressive as the theory may be seen to be able to kill so many birds with a stone. What about structure formation? And that is that, in fact, if you ask serious theoreticians today about the true value of inflation, okay, anyone who can be forthright with you, they will say that really inflation is about structure formation. All the other things are just icing on the cake. We see these little anisotropy fluctuations on the CMB surface. That are purported to be the seeds of today's galaxies and clusters. And so, what planted them in the first place? Because if, in addition to having inflation to explain flatness and the horizon problem, you also need something else to, other than inflation, to explain these seeds, then the theory may still stand, but wouldn't have retain so much charm as before. Now, the model as it stands says that it turns out that these seeds were planted during inflation too, which means the theory can account for them in principle. The hardest part really is to do with the super horizon perturbation amplitude, as well as the shape of the scaling function of this amplitude with distance on those scales. Now, by this I mean the power spectrum of mass and isotropy or mass fluctuation. And that is that if you look at the CMB, okay, at very low L, that there is a residual anisotropy, it isn't zero. And moreover, the curve becomes horizontal in the TT correlation diagram. And this part of the graph tells you that the P of K function, or the mass density power spectrum, it scales as k to the power n, where n is close to 1, and moreover, the normalization is such that the on-horizon entry is about 1 part 10 to the 5. And so let me explain a little bit, and I think most of you know better than I do about what is going on here. And that is that you have a Fourier transform of the density contrast in real space, and then the modulus square of that gives you the power spectrum of mass fluctuations. And that could be understood in real space by constructing spheres of a certain given radius, which you can take to be the co-moving radius to take away the expansion of the universe, and then to look at the percentage change of density or mass from one sphere of that radius to another. And it turns out if P of k scales as k to the power n in Fourier space, then you get this type of dependence. And that's the variance of the density contrast with scale as 1 over the radius of the sphere to the power 3 plus n when n is less than 1 and to the power 4 when n is greater than 1. Okay, now, so that would mean that if the little n is close to 1, then the variance with scale is 1 over r to the 4. But the other notable point is that when n is greater than 1, then the variance would continue to scale as 1 over r to the 4, no matter what n is. Okay. So that means that when if you see 1 over r to the 4 sort of a dependence, it doesn't mean n equals 1. It could mean that, but it could also mean something else. But in any case, 1 over r to the 4 is very curious type of scaling. It certainly isn't possible.
So there's something
yes.
wrong here, I think, because
yes.
You're assuming that, I think you're assuming that there's a lower limit or upper limit to the integral, which you're ignoring, and that's not necessarily ignorable, right? Okay.
Yes, I think what you're saying is that at some point, this k to the power n scaling has to flatten. A sufficiently large k that you cannot just simply have an indefinite
yeah.
behavior shooting upwards, p of k to k. That is true, and that has to be assumed. Otherwise, the integral will diverge.
Because, right. I mean, I know in practice,
yes.
you can, in observation, they say,
yes.
measure n even if it's larger than 1. So.
Yes. And usually that length scale, or shall we say the reciprocal length scale, is set at the horizon, and that is the for k larger than 1 over the horizon size, then the primordial perturbation theory ceases, and it's going to be taken over by more standard physics. Because once you're inside the horizon, then everything becomes causally linked. And the perturbation
so this is only on
yes.
super horizon scales.
Yes, and so this is true only for super horizon, and I'm not sure if I've stated this anywhere. But I think in earlier... All right, anyway, I think eventually I'm going to declare it more explicitly. But yes, it's a good point, and that is that these length scales here are all to do with primordial density fluctuations, and that is to do with points separated on the last scattering surface by more than one horizon in size, points that can't talk to each other.
Are you saying if I have a bluer spectrum, I wouldn't
distinguish
it in real space? If I
have
a bluer spectrum?
Bluer. Yeah. That's
n larger than 1. Then in real space,
yes.
people couldn't distinguish it?
Yes. If you in real space, you see 1 over r to the 4, it could mean anything to do with n. Okay. Provided n is greater than 1.
That's on super horizon scale.
Yes, that is again dealing with super horizon sized spheres. Okay, but of course, there is one caveat here, and that is that I have assumed what is known as a top hat window function for the sphere. Sometimes it is known as spherical squares. Okay, and that is that if you were to use a Gaussian window function, namely that if the radius of the sphere is not depicting a sharp boundary, okay, but instead there is some sort of gradually tapering off window, then you can get something else very different from this. But the Gaussian window function has problems in the sense that it actually hides away a lot of the physics, of true physics, and most people actually prefer to just use the top the real speed, shall we say? Mm-hmm. Okay, so not Gaussian.
Less than 400, something like that.
Yes, I think the at the time of equality is 33 megaparsec. If you assume a Hubble constant of 7, about 33, yes. And so that means on length scales shorter than that, you don't have fine audio fluctuations. Okay.
So if you want to think of the spectrum, that yeah. part of it doesn't have any information about the
Fourier array. That's right. Precisely. And then if you look at real space, you can't figure out what's happening in Fourier space. Maybe this is a reason why folks prefer to work in Fourier space because it's more discriminating.
So when observers make the measurements,
yes.
I always thought it was like in physical space. Like you look at the temperature here, you look at the temperature.
No, actually, you don't. Analysis of WWF data are all done in Fourier space.
But when the data yes. is taken, how is it taken? Isn't it taken from a point in the sky?
Yes, the data were taken in real space. That is very true. There are various reasons for wanting to. Now you're asking me something I feel at home about. Relatively, and then it's that you know when it comes to observations, you would like to work in Fourier space, even though you gather the data in real space. That is because in Fourier space it enables you to take away effects like beam size differences between filters, etc., more easily. Because a convolution in real space becomes a multiplication in Fourier space. So those are purely data analysis advantages that motivated people to immediately do a Fourier transform. It doesn't mean the data were gathered in Fourier space.
So does that obscure some of the features? Like, if you have a cutoff in real space, suppose something explodes,
yes.
you know, back to causality, right?
Yes.
It explodes and the particles get a certain distance apart,
yes.
and you say, well, where are the perturbations? Well, the perturbations are constrained by causality. That was the initial problem.
Yes.
But that means that there's actually a cutoff in real space beyond which there's just nothing. You don't measure anything. Where in Fourier space, you could have this long tail.
Yes,
so I just wonder, how does that figure in? Is one looking at long tail artifacts?
Yeah, what you are raising is a point that's been long debated in the literature. I don't think it's ever been settled. I mean, in fact, what this view graph highlights is a very small subset of these complications. And it is that really the real space and the Fourier space are different things. And there is no clear way of mapping from one to the other.
There is a very clear way between
but you have to
know the Fourier space contains all of the information in real space.
If you have a whole space, but if you have a finite amount of space, then they're not the same.
Well, they're very close. I mean,
that's the thing.
You have to work really hard to make some. You have to work really hard to make something that doesn't have a very good Fourier transform. That doesn't capture virtually all of the information. It is a really, really exceptional situation. It's just a situation for a Fourier transform not to do an exceptionally good job. We use them all over the place in physics, and they always work. And
but
the reason
I'm
why is for very little. No, I know.
But
it's
not
very
n greater than 1.
No, but I think that you should think of different. From a mathematical view, you're absolutely right.
No, I'm talking about the world.
But what I mean is that from the viewpoint of someone who gathered some data and wanted to understand and organize those data. To arrive at certain conclusions, then I do think you have to be careful. For instance, if there is a difference between the choice of a top hat window function and a Gaussian, right, the difference is non-trivial, then you have to ask what sort of window function is appropriate to my observation.
Well, by all means, you can have bad window functions that give you spurious artifacts.
Yes.
But that's not saying that Fourier space is wrong.
To see something that's causally constrained, something that actually goes to zero, for r greater than some r zero, that's clear if you're looking at a configuration space.
Mm-hmm.
In Fourier space,
you can see a clear separation of the you may have some tiny tail, but you're going to notice that that's a tail compared to the big numbers that you get for the amplitudes close to the relevant to the momentum nodes that are relevant to the problem.
mean, you don't, if you see something that's trailing off, just remember, we always remember that we're working with configuration spaces there too. So if you see something that's trailing off that just looks like an artifact, and you say, hey, look, that's an artifact, you don't say, oh, look, I found something, right?
Well, so this is, again, just showing my ignorance, but when I looked at that slide that you call the flat, with the flat portion, that looked like, is that what we're, all this is about? That looks like an art, really small down there, there's a couple of dots.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you're telling me that those are very robust observations. I believe you, because I don't know anything about observations, so I can meet you very honest.
Yeah.
Exactly. But to me, that looks like something that, you know, I don't know how it's like these three dots.
For which?
A couple of, actually,
yes, yes. I think you're talking about the acoustic.
You're not happy.
No.
Maybe we should. I mean, you assume one of it.
Is it the flat section? I see, like,
no,
there's
nothing.
Three
dots. No, that's not the flat section. The flatness, you see the main peak where the best data are. The fact that that lies at approximately 1 degree,
yes,
it tells us that it's, the universe is flat.
And
yes,
it's not about, she's not talking about that flat.
Okay, but that's
right. Therefore, I mean, it doesn't even look flat to me at all. It's like
quite
a circle.
Yeah.
So, but you see, the characteristic behavior is that if you have a causal behavior, you have got that, like you're talking about, and if you take a Fourier transform, then you would see something that goes as L squared. So the question is, how much is that different from L squared? And that's the the confidence at which you rule out basically causal somewhere. And that looks pretty much different from an L squared because C sub L is constant for those scenarios. That goes as L squared. So that's, yeah, I mean, you can take it or leave it. I don't know, it's maybe at 10 sigma, maybe 15 sigma.
Yes, yes, that's right. It's really when this L plus 1 C spell is, it becomes a constant at low L, then you conclude the P of K goes as K. The data are, in fact, taken in real space, that is true. I mean, your question is why we then go to Fourier space and take that approach when it's all done in real space. But I think that is that there are many reasons. I mean, I think the biggest one is convenience, and that is that if you want to take away convolution effects, then Fourier space is easy.
Can I ask a quick link?
Yes.
Whenever I hear this discussion, people always talk about Fourier transforms.
Yes.
Has anyone ever done analysis using wavelet transforms?
Yes.
Yes. CMB was analyzed using wavelet transforms.
Does it help in any way? Or is it
as far as I can tell, I've read some of these papers and they do a lot of work in different ways.
Yes, we've done ourselves with wavelet transforms CMB, and the amplitude of on the degree scale acoustic peak of anisotropy is about the same on that same scale, on that scale. There are no big differences. Yes. All right. So far we talked about only the shape, okay, of the power spectrum. But then there's the question of normalization, and it is the normalization where the horizon scale comes in. And then it's that Nilesh asked about whether these are all to do with super horizon perturbation. The answer is yes. Inside the horizon, you can't use the formula. Oops. Okay, so in fact, on the horizon, then this will be a convenient place to set normalization. It turns out, in order to explain that flat portion of the acoustic curve, namely at low L, C sub L times L plus 1 is constant, that the numerical value of that constant sets the perturbation amplitude at 10 to the minus 5, or the variance at 10 to the minus 10. All right. Now, if you were to ask about the CMB itself, and to say, supposing the universe was were completely smooth, okay, now this is one of those completely crazy questions you could raise, and that is, what sort of noise you expect from the intrinsic blackbody fluctuations, all right, at 3 degrees? Now, of course, we know that even at thermodynamic equilibrium, everything is ironed out as much as possible. Entropy is maximal. Nevertheless, there are still fluctuations. There is still noise, known as thermal noise. And thermal noise turns out on the horizon scale of matter radiation equality, the co-moving scale, okay, for a 3-degree background, would give you a variance, all right, for the density contrast of 1 part per 10 to the 81. But whereas we are seeing 1 part per 10 to the 10 for the variance, right, 10 minus 5 for standard deviation. So clearly, here, we can't be dealing with anything like that. There's some other forms of seed sowing that must have taken place at times before math radiation equality, and certainly well before decoupling. All right. So this is perhaps another way of saying that those seeds would have to be made or planted well ahead of time. You just simply can't pick a universe that consisted of a radiation phase in complete thermal equilibrium and expect to form structures of today. Right, that would be too smooth a universe by many, many orders of magnitude. So here, I wish to show the graph, and that is that if you were to think about the density contrast in real space, and you have the variance on the y-axis, and you have scale on the x-axis, or imagine that all these scales are super horizon. So you start off with something on the leftmost part of the curve, which could be the horizon distance, okay, at some epoch. And then you see the 1 over R4 curve far above. So that means imagine 10 to minus 10 here, 10 to minus 81 there. But then eventually, because one scales is 1 over R to the 4, whereas the boson black body noise scales is 1 over R cubed, then at some point, all right, so at some very large super horizon scale, then the two curves will unavoidably cross each other. And then what happens beyond that is that you will have a super horizon density contrast that's actually subthermal. And that is that you are then smoother than the state of thermal equilibrium.
So you're talking about the smaller scales there, not larger scales. So these are very small scales.
In K, you mean?
No, this is R, right?
Yes, as you continue,
oh, sorry, this is large R.
Yes,
right,
very large R.
I see.
Okay. So, but of course, this R is unrealistically large, so why worry about it? All right, so this is purely a matter of principle, and that is that once this crossover happens, all right, so the primordial fluctuations will have actually done beyond anybody's dreams. And it is to create a super orderly state. Now, so, but we don't need to even to think such terms, because it isn't what's happening. I mean, there are so many orders of magnitude on the horizon, a difference between the intrinsic noise and the ring noise. All right, so that also, all that this tells us really is that during the phase of inflation, any density seeds, okay, that gets planted, well, would then eventually get stretched out into a region that can't possibly talk to each other at the end of that period when reheating takes place. So then those seeds would have to take a long, long time to reach thermal equilibrium. They start off with something that's that has high amplitude of density contrast, and eventually, given time, they may then return to equilibrium, but it will take a very long time, because they're not talking to each other. So the point to be made then is that somehow inflation has to generate these density perturbations as well. You just can't let intrinsic noise do the job. So altogether here, I can find debating near yesterday how many assumptions the standard model has to make in order to explain what we actually see. So here is a table that I compiled that some of these assumptions, and perhaps all of them already are here, but it's only very recently I noticed that inflation itself is not sufficient. You actually have to invoke vacuum fluctuation in the inflationary force vacuum in order to explain the density seeds at super horizon scales. And then, not to mention that none of these things have been, these phenomena were verified in the lab. Here is a table that brings up some of the successes of astrophysics rather than cosmology. And you could tell that the story there is quite different. and that is that astrophysicists tend to use known physics that happened here down on Earth to explain what's up there in the sky. And every time if this turns out to be to things work out to expect, to account for the data, then we have that's when people open their champagne bottles. But I think cosmology, to be fair, is a very different subject altogether, and we shouldn't draw too strict a parallel, a comparison. But I think it's still useful to bear in mind that even cosmologists should be careful about enlisting too many assumptions that have not been verified. All right, now, the purpose of this talk is the following, is to say, well, can we strike off some of these assumptions? And then it's that, all right, let's say we have universal inflation. We allow the possibility of dark energy and cosmological constant operating more than once, okay, maybe twice. But then, without the vacuum fluctuations, you would have homogeneous space on superhorizon scales, and perhaps a zero curvature. But this will not explain structures, and structures are very dear to many observers, and therefore, and so that will not be satisfactory. All right, so let me go to the previous view problem, and that is to say that it points out that at equality, the intrinsic black hole universe is just so much calmer than the intrinsic fluctuations that must have been due to the seeds being planted. So how could we possibly avoid having to make another assumption of vacuum fluctuations during inflation? Well, but before we move off too fast here, The more pertinent question to ask is, what's the intrinsic density contrast at the horizon during the end of the inflation? Okay, because it is really at that point that the thermal phase of the universe commences, not at radiation mass equality, because that's when it's ended. At least the radiation part. So it turns out, interestingly, if you were to ask this question, then the answer, it may surprise you, is 1 part 10 to the 5.
I'm surprised.
It is actually not that hard to calculate. Now, you could take a co-moving universe in which the black hole temperature doesn't change, and then what happens is that the horizon changes. And so if you were to push the time all the way back to at the end of the inflation, then the horizon was very small, even it was at its minimum. Afterwards started to grow again, you see. And it was at that point that the scaling of all these things, whether you believe in 1 over r4 or 1 over r3, always when you go to small r, density contrast shoots up. Now, if you take intrinsic black body noise, which is backed by very sound physics, then the scaling
just
will be
for sound noise, right?
Yes. Then the scaling will be 1 over r3. And so you take the 1 over r3 and just push it all the way to the scale of as small as the horizon co-moving length at the end of the inflation, then you do get something a lot larger than 10 minus 81. And so it was when I noticed this 10 to the minus 5 that I started to ring up Tom Cable at night and so on. He didn't like it, of course. But at first, I have to say, he completely misunderstood me. But then when he realized there is this coincidence and checked himself and verified it's correct, then perhaps something ought to be considered more seriously. So here we have the following picture, and that is that if you were to look at the universe at the time straight after inflation, then on the horizon, you 10 to minus 5 here, and then going beyond that, the Poisson curve would go down like this, and the primordial curve would go down like that if you assume n equals 1. And of course, this would mean that the primordial curve lies well beneath the Poisson curve, and then so here you are dealing with a super orderly state, in other words. And then you have something that is, a universe that is smoother than thermal equilibrium. Okay, now, apart from whether this is possible or not, we reckon it is possible. Okay, and that is that if you have a vacuum that's completely uniform, reheating itself into particles, then you can initially form this, and then eventually you allow the various regions to interact, then this curve will develop into that curve. And of course, it takes time. And it is the larger the scale, then the longer you have to wait, because these are all well beyond causal distances. Now, I don't know if there are any questions, but I probably am running out of time. So so here's a picture of Poisson fluctuations versus the Harrison sandwich. So you can see that one is in fact more ordered than the other. Now, once you plant the seeds, then the seeds will grow. At least in the synchronous gauge, they will grow. They grow linearly with time during the radiation phase. But in general, I think they grow as the square of the horizon radius. All right. But then why choose the synchronous gauge? There are other gauges like Newtonian gauge in which the seeds don't grow. But it turns out the convenient point, a thing about synchronous gauge, the one that in which you don't mess up the time part of the metric when you perturb it using density contrast, is that you can just simply use the mean properties of the universe as if you know you if you're having an FRW metric, as such as the CMB temperature is still 3 degrees, okay, co-moving. And you don't have to actually change any of this. Whereas other gauges, you do have to make such adjustments. Okay, so if you were to just simply want to continue using 3 degrees for the CMB, then the synchronous gauge would be a good choice. But then in that gauge, that even a contrast which were planted at the end of inflation, once radiation error commences, and you're a super horizon a seed, then it will grow linear, or you will grow linear. Okay, so this is what I'm talking about. Our H square actually scales as T during radiation error. All right, so a contrast of 10 to minus 5 is useful because if the contrast scales as the horizon radius, that means that eventually when a density seed re-enters the horizon, and that is that when the horizon grows fast enough or far enough into the radiation era, that it catches up with that mode, then it would re-enter also at 10 to the minus 5 amplitude. Because everything simply scales according to this law here. So another way of looking at it is to go back to this, a curve further down. Yes, what happens is that this curve 1 over r to the 4, forget our cube number, would just come up vertically as time goes on because of the growing, but at the same time the horizon will come up. So always the interplay between the vertical action and the horizontal action means that at any given time on the horizon you have 10 to minus 5. Okay, they always meet each other here. I should raise my two hands further. Okay, and then beyond that, it will scale as 1 over r to the 4. Now, 1 over r to the 4 is actually not hard to explain. Because now that we know the amplitude, right, we might as well try to get the index right. Now, that is not hard to explain because you imagine you have a super horizon sphere that is completely uniform to start with, okay, after reheating. But then at the surface of the sphere, one horizon thickness, those particles can communicate with the horizon. They can perturb the density of that horizon. Even though, of course, on largest, you deal with thicker layers, they can't. Okay, so you can do a simple calculation, and you just say the number of particles in this shell. All right, that will be proportional to r squared times the thickness of the shell, which is one horizon. And then you then say that what is the variance in number of particles of inside the whole sphere, okay, is it of order this n prime, all right, because that's what's perturbing the sphere. Well, then very quickly you arrive at the conclusion that the ratio of the variance to the mean equals to 1 over r squared, or scales is 1 over r squared. Okay, so that means the variance in the density contrast itself scales is 1 over r to the 4. Alright, so it means that you can get both the amplitude on the horizon as well as the index correctly, or at least potentially the index. Because 1 over r 4 doesn't mean you're all the way there. It doesn't mean n equals 1. It means n greater than 1 or equal to 1. And so that part still needs explanation. But I think I'm running out of time. I should really stop. I'm sorry. Let me just go back to... Yes, so this is just a little bit of mathematics, but I think I've already said it. And here are just some equations about black body noise, but the crucial view graph is here, and that is that when R is RH, you have about 10 to minus 5 during reheating, and then outside horizon is scales is 1 over R square, or the contrast one in varying terms, 1 over R 4. Now, it turns out a straightforward displacement of classical particles during a diffusion surface layer mechanism that conserves the center of mass position, which is another way of saying that there's momentum balance, would not give you P of K going as K. It would just give you P of K going as K to the 4. It's a well-known theorem, actually, first formulated by Zeldovich, and it's known as today as Zeldovich bound. And so this would still give you 1 over r to the 4 for the variance, but it's not k. What we measure with WMAP is k. So how do we overcome this? Here is just another way of explaining it, but I think I can stop after this view graph. And that is that you take a particle and you split it into two, and they move in opposite directions so that on average your momentum conversion and center of mass does not move. And you then assume that the probability of moving a distance that is smaller than the horizon scale is about 1, or something constant. But if you move a distance larger than the horizon distance, then you have to cut it off. If you cut it off exponentially, then that's when you get k to the 4. If you cut it off algebraically, however, okay, which means that you, instead of cutting it off using an exponential, you use a power law type of cutoff. Well, then it turns out, depending on the index of this power law beyond horizons distance of displacement, you can get P of K going as K. Okay, in general, the limit is not as tight as the Zeldovich bound, as long as it's K to the n greater than or equal to 0 even. So then you may ask, well, how is it possible? I think the only conclusion, in fact, people have been studying this for some time, and that is that we know that reheating is not a classical process. But moreover, we know that quantum particles don't act like classical particles. And that is that when particles interact, okay, the correlation length, we can actually be very large. But this is just another way of saying that quantum mechanically particles are not localized. And it is entirely conceivable that the cutoff on superhorizon scales of the probability of a displacement is algebraic rather than exponential. So this is since this is a period in which the physics is not terribly well understood, and that is that we're going to need quantum mechanics. Because the amplitude agreement with what WMAP measures on the horizon is so attractive that I don't think we should just give it up altogether simply because the index based upon a classical particle assumption is wrong. Now, I want to point out finally that even when you look at conventional black body noise, okay, the black body noise itself, based upon both Einstein statistics, okay, for photons, would give you a variance for the noise for each mode that has two terms in it. One is Poisson noise, which delta n squared goes as n, That's spontaneous emission. Delta N squared going as N squared, that is stimulated emission. For a long time, in terms of this part, this term, when integrated over all modes, gives you the total noise contribution from the stimulated part, has not been explained. But it turns out it can be explained, and I wrote a second paper to back up this first paper. Because it was quite beautiful. It can be explained by simply assuming that classical waves, instead of photons, when they superpose upon each other, these normal modes of the Planck originally invoked to explain the black body cavity, at random phases would give you a wave train that has no particular space or time confinement, but would have fluctuation of all length scales or time scales. And that is, in fact, what we see in terms of the n squared term. When you superpose classical wave trains with no photons, a concept of radiation, at random phases, you then explain that n squared noise, which is part of the black body noise function. And so conclusion is that even if you are looking at conventional black body radiation, let alone all the exotic physics that might have been going on at the time of the heating, but you still have to invoke a non-classical concept of particles. That means that the radiation is not photons only, okay, not just simply counting marbles, you know, not just Poisson statistics. There's another part of it that is to do with the radiation being waves. They're completely non-localized. And if they're non-localized, then you can't just use classical ping-pong particles, displacement of particles splitting, center of mass and all those concepts. And this, I think, further paves the way to the possibility that P of K can be K with the right amplitude as well. So I'll just stop here. Thank you. Thank you.
So, questions?
I'm sorry I asked that long question about Fourier transforms. I think you used up a lot of your time. In my understanding of the last part of your talk, in terms of that we're not talking about this Guthin-P-Stravinsky picture of freezing the amplitude at the rising cross. So we're not talking about that at all. Instead, there's another process that you're talking about that there's quantum correlations on a scale that's larger than what we think from classical
momentum. That's right. The correlation function is not sharp. Yes.
All right, so I'm on the right picture. So how much larger can we expect? So like if you compute commutation relations, if we take equal time commutators, like how do those fall off? Can we expect power law or exponential?
Yeah, I believe I'm sure that folks here have much more knowledge on this than I am. But I believe quantum field theory in flat space-time, the normal quantum field theory, does permit this sort of thing to happen. And that is, you can have power law-type correlation functions between particles in a quantum mechanical fluid. But the difficulty is in what happens when you have a curved space substratum, and as you have an expanding ether, that in which the at least time is curved, even if space is flat, because once you expand space time, then time is curved. But then there is no formulation, in fact, and the straightforward answer to your question. But there are a couple of papers published by Andrea Gabrielli, as well as Francesco Labini, I think. They put a few papers up in which they gave toy models of this sort of thing. And one of them, I think what they, instead of having an expanding universe, what they did was they assumed an ensemble of Coulomb particles of different opposite charges, equal number. And then beyond some length scale, you have device a screening. And then the Coulomb potential drops off exponentially. So they said, well, this could be a mimicking of a horizon cutoff. But then they ask, would there be other interaction potentials that are not Coulombic, okay, that it would give you a screening link that falls off as a power law rather than exponential? And it turns out there is. If, for example, the potential is one over R squared rather than one over R, which is Coulomb, then you can have you can do such a feat. So that was explained in the calculator in one of the Europhysics letters papers. But it is still not satisfactory because here you're still dealing with classical particles in which you mimic the horizon cutoff by the divide form of screening. What is really needed is QFT in curved space-time. And
that, but that's just what inflation does. But I'm the thing is that you want to do something different, right?
Yes, but I don't know if inflation theory has a unique and well-formulated general theory of QFT in curved space-time.
That's what they claim.
They don't have to assume that. That's the whole beauty. The nice thing about inflation is you don't have to assume anything. Everything is on your world.
But there is a sort of slurl.
You have to make approximations. But you can control them at the level of tuning.
Yes.
But there's nothing special about the QFT that you
use. I see. Okay. But you do have to assume certain things about inflation. You do assume that conditions don't change, and also the amplitude of tension minus
right.
phi.
Right. I mean, you're constructing a model that it realizes the things that you need is hard. But I mean, the QFT is not the problem.
I see.
QFT itself, curved space as well.
Oh, okay.
I would disagree with I'm not sure which of those statements, but I think. So that, again, this is just. But the problem, you have to address the classical to quantum transition in the following sense, that at least going back to Kuznets' calculation, to get this spectrum of fluctuations that are quantum fluctuations, because you're in a homogeneous state and you want something with variation in space, otherwise you don't have density contrast to grow up to be structure, we want structure. Then what they do is use the two-point function. So of course, phi at x, phi at y, excitation volume, that depends upon the separation x minus y and does have structure. But it doesn't address the question of, does classical gravity couple to the two-point function? So to me, this is to me, there's an important issue there about the prescription to go from this quantum state, which is its quantum richness, to what the classical measuring device, the classical gravitational field, responds to and grows up and creates classical density. So I would not say that's under control.
There's a different question I think you're getting at, which is whether the perturbations are one way might support classical, because there are in quantum state. But the metric is also one. You quantize the metric. So there's no problem with field theory in curved space time, even coupled to gravity. Normalizability is not an issue. And you can still do calculations. I think you were getting in a more esoteric question, is how do those fluctuations gain consequence? But there's a well-defined argument.
Well, I know there's arguments that are certainly well articulated.
Yeah.
Perhaps we could talk, I'd be happy to talk about the steps that you summarize.
Well, so the zero sort of thing is that what you have is a highly squeezed state, which looks very classical. So the difference between the two-point function of the quantum state and the classical state is negligibly small, as you notice it's bad. But even on top of that, then you could have some kind of coherent interaction with little fields, level matrices. But this is all way beyond.
But the thing is, do you really need that? Because if the Poisson noise is enough to give you the right order of magnitude of fluctuation, do you need any slurl? Do you need any scalar field filament?
There's no super horizon correlations.
Well.
But that's the horizon.
Yeah, well, I mean, you may still have, I mean, I don't understand. You know, I don't think you ever are actually explaining where the 2-5 came from, but even if I grant you that, the fact is that you still haven't explained why that side of the sky and that side of the sky are the same.
But after inflation, there is a still inflation. So you don't.
I mean, you could still.
Why there's 80 adiabatic perturbations that gave you the variant acoustic.
Well, what I try to reduce it is just one assumption, and that is, do we need the density seeds that were generated during inflation? Do we still need those perturbations? Since, in fact, you could just let inflation end in the universe in a homogeneous state and let the diffusion of particles, at least if those are diffusion of quantum particles, it would give you the right amplitude on the horizon. That I think, is the magic. And then it could also give you the right index. But the amplitude on the horizon is a trivial calculation. You just take the black body noise and at 3 degrees and put in the horizon scale at the GU.
Wait, 3 degrees? Put the answer in.
That 10 to the 14 GeV, that's the number.
Well, you put in 3 degrees for that.
Yes, of course.
Well, then that's the answer. I mean, you put.
But I didn't assume any answers.
But you said you put 3 degrees in.
But that's not 10 to the minus 5.
That's not what gives. I mean, that gives 10 to the minus 5, but the point is, why should it? It doesn't have to. I mean, it could give you on the GUT horizon, it could give you any other density perturbation. But if it does give you that, it would seem like, in the very least, additional to inflation perturbations, that these perturbations have to be reckoned with. Because these are unavoidable. They're over there. This is the minimum noise on the horizon due to.
But the difference is that this is the horizon after reheating.
Yes.
Which is much smaller. This is a much smaller Kolmogorov scale than the scales we're dealing with right now.
The horizon was at its minimum on Kolmogorov scale.
That's
at reheating. But that is also when the thermal universe began.
That's right. I agree. But I'm saying that then there is a non-trivial step to go from the horizon after reheating to horizon today. And because their scales are at least co-moving, in common accordance, their scales are elastic.
No, I see what you mean. Yes, there may be some, but I mean, okay, so you just simply start from the horizon of today and assume a thermal universe evolution and take it yourself back to the GUT phase, mm-hmm. and you will compute the horizon, this radius, co-moving, and GUT phase. I don't see why it is not unique. Now, what you think may be that what happens before that,
we can discuss that later, but it's just the point is that the scale in co-moving coordinates, the horizon at the end of inflation is basically 60-fold in the smaller than the Kolmogorov scales that we are seeing observing today.
Oh yes, that is true. But that is just to do what was in causal content, what no longer is after inflation. But what I mean is that still the Kolmogorov horizon size at the end GUT phase is
we should
calculate easily and hence get the black body noise of 3 degrees on that scale. That's how we got 10 minus 5. Yes.
Any more questions?
You have
I think you're looking for some quantum miracle to think structure from the horizon at the end of inflation to the quarter of the horizon today. And I think it's not possible because stress energy is conserved, even in quantum theory. And if you ask what is really the origin behind Zeldovich's argument,
yes,
Jenny well knows. They've written papers on it. It's just your energy conservation. It's nothing to do with particles. Per se, and it will apply equally well to quantum field. I don't think there's any way to
get
around with K4.
K4 is
it's just as valid in quantum field.
Yes, so what Tom said to me was that he would like to see a general proof.
Mm-hmm.
He said that he will concede if this proof exists that does not. I mean, that applies to quantum field theory in current space time.
Well, this is part of my big, is that you you have to commit yourself to what the quantum story is. Mm-hmm. Right? And if at some point the quantum, you're talking about quantum configurations that are obeying the Einstein constraint equations, then there's definite things they have to satisfy.
Yeah.
If someone's going to say, well, this doesn't have to obey the Einstein constraint equations, okay, then I don't know what that's like.
Yeah, but that's just do it all in one go. Everything is quantum. Mm-hmm. And we use the quantum correlation functions, and they all go away.
So if there's some place where in configuration space it actually goes to zero.
Which the correlation goes to zero. That's right, yeah. So if the correlation function cuts off, so by assumption,
right.
You're starting in a quantum state that doesn't have long range correlation. So the density can't generate.
Okay, so that's really the sort of theorem we're looking for, and it's the space, the point, all that things. Energy conservation argument.
But then it's not as strong as. Okay, maybe.
So if this theorem exists independent of details of quantum correlation, then I think we're dead, yes.
So we're taking. And that's why we're taking Richard to dinner tonight at 6:30. You're welcome to join us. Let's thank Richard again.